Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. President Barack Obama secured a landmark foreign policy victory Wednesday as Senate Democrats amassed enough votes to ensure the Iran nuclear deal survives in Congress, despite ferocious opposition from Republicans and the government of Israel. Democratic Senator Barbara Mikulski became the crucial 34th vote in favor of the agreement in the 100-member chamber. The backing from Mikulski gives supporters the margin they need to uphold an Obama veto of a congressional resolution of disapproval if Republicans pass such a measure later this month. So far, there's been no immediate reaction from the Israeli government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. A former Congolese rebel leader known as the Terminator has pleaded not guilty to charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Bosco Ntaganda entered his plea Wednesday on the first day of his trial at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Prosecutors say Ntaganda is responsible for atrocities committed by his rebel group, the Union of Congolese Patriots, in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo in 2002 and 2003. He faces 13 counts of war crimes and 5 counts of crimes against humanity that include charges of murder, rape, and sexual slavery. Gunmen wearing military uniforms kidnapped 18 Turkish workers Wednesday in Iraq's capital. The workers are employed by the construction company Nural Insat. They are constructing a soccer stadium complex in northeastern Baghdad. The gunmen kidnapped the workers around 3 a.m. There's no indication of the identity of who they are or what their motive is. This is VOA News. At least 2,000 people are stranded at the main international train station in Budapest, Hungary, after authorities abruptly stopped allowing migrants to travel to Germany and Austria without a visa from the European Union. Under EU rules, migrants must first seek asylum in the first country they enter. However, inconsistent application of the rules has left many of the migrants in limbo, since many have neither the necessary documents nor the money to purchase train tickets. A spokesman for the United Nations Refugee Agency, Bobar Balak, spoke to VOA and said all countries need to do their part.
All the countries on the way have their own responsibilities in terms of how to deal with these people. So they need to be received better, treated humanly and with dignity.
The 28-member EU plans to hold emergency talks on the issue on September 14th. Major stock markets in China and elsewhere in the region saw another day of volatile trading Wednesday. Shanghai stocks plunged nearly 4.5% at the opening before recovering to finish down 0.2%. In Tokyo, the Nikkei also tumbled in morning trading. Trading was basically flat in Seoul and Sydney. Meanwhile, the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, is on a visit to Indonesia. On Wednesday, she said the recent market volatility shows how rapidly concerns can spread from one region to the next.
What has been demonstrated in the last few weeks is also how much Asia is at the core of global economy.
Again, that is the IMF head, Christine Lagarde. North Korea has denied apologizing for a landmine explosion that injured 2 South Koreans and says Seoul risks hurting bilateral relations if it implies otherwise. The North's expression of regret over the attack was a central part of a deal reached last week. Meanwhile, South Korea's unification ministry on Wednesday deflected questions about that apology dispute, saying both sides should instead focus on implementing the agreement. That is the ministry spokesman Jung Jun-hee. He says that, in fact, the expression of regret was included, and it's not time for us to ride an emotional roller coaster or argue over what's right and wrong about the agreement. Under the terms of the agreement, North Korea expressed regret for the landmine incident. In return, South Korea shut off anti-Pyongyang propaganda broadcasts into the North. Thailand's military junta and police are speaking of significant progress in their investigation of last month's bombing of a Bangkok shrine that left 20 people dead and wounded more than 120 others. Authorities are talking about a foreign man arrested at Thailand's border with Cambodia whose fingerprints match those at the scene. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations Children's Fund says the number of women and children fleeing countries of violence heading for Europe has increased sharply in recent months. UNICEF says those arriving in the gateway country of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia has tripled in the past 3 months.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next.
Also in the news, more than 300 illegal migrants, mostly Ethiopians, are detained in Malawi prisons after finishing their sentences. And the first ever World Hepatitis Summit opens in Glasgow, Scotland.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the United Nations Children's Fund says the number of women and children fleeing countries of violence heading for Europe has increased sharply in recent months. UNICEF says those arriving in the gateway country of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia has tripled in the past 3 months. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says some 3,000 people arrive in Macedonia every day. It says one-third of them are women and children. Most are refugees fleeing war and persecution in their countries of origin. 80% are from Syria and 10% from Afghanistan and Iraq. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouillirac tells VOA many families, including many children, have been on the move for weeks, even months, enduring searing heat and other enormous hardships. He says many arrive at the Macedonian border with only the clothes on their backs. All are physically exhausted.
They are suffering dehydration, blisters, cold, diarrhea, and sunburn. 12% of women arriving are pregnant, and we got many stories of women starting bleeding and losing their child, for instance, in Greece.
Bouillirac says UNICEF is particularly concerned about the well-being of the children.
Those who left Syria, for instance, just went through very difficult time, but the children don't speak, and it's not a good sign, you know. It shows a kind of trauma, and some of them are clearly psychosocially and psychologically traumatized.
The refugees do not stay long in Macedonia. They are just transiting through the country on their way to the European Union, where they hope to find refuge. Nevertheless, Bouillirac says UNICEF is intent on easing their condition while they are in the country, and particularly to bring a bit of joy into the hearts of the children.
That's why we have this child-friendly space, which allows them to play and to be a bit more, you know, to feel more at ease and change of world for a few hours, because they don't stay too long at that border.
Since UNICEF set up the first child-friendly spaces on August 23rd, it has received around 1,200 children. Bouillirac says the need is so huge, the agency is planning to set up more play stations to accommodate ever more children who arrive in a state of distress. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Europe is facing mounting criticism over how it is handling its biggest migration crisis since World War II. But not all Europeans believe building walls or passing repressive policies are the answer. From the French port city of Calais, Lisa Bryan reports on one migrant school that is opening doors and building bonds across nationalities.
French lessons at the Chemin des Dunes school. These students are learning terms for the weather, rain, wind, and snow, which many of these Sudanese and Eritreans will soon be seeing for the first time. They're here to study art, Tai Chi, and especially French and English, languages that can help them apply for legal status in France or in Britain, just across the English Channel. Nigerian migrant Simeko Jones, who founded the school, says it's also bringing together Calais' diverse migrant community.
Maybe you saw this Kosovar. He come to school. You see knife blacks, you know, from Sudan. sometimes Afghan, two Afghan, three Afghan. Yeah. But for me, it's a pleasure for me to see them live together, you know, sit down together, unite together.
La pluie, la neige.
La neige.
The school opened in July in this Calais migrant camp that's known as the jungle. Today, classes are spilling over.
Le nu.
Wasim Mohammed from Pakistan arrived in Calais 6 weeks ago. He's hoping to find work in France. Migrants at the jungle told him about the school.
They told me that if you learn to, French language, there is a school in jungle. Is it free of charge? So that's why I decided to get the French lesson here today.
The school has a growing roster of volunteer teachers, like speech therapist Virginie Thiberguin, who lives in the area. Some Calais residents have staged protests against the migrants, but others, like Thiberguin, want to help them.
I often see people on the road, and I wanted to meet them, to know the way they were living here. The school is a way to restore humanity, and so it's a good thing.
The children. Volunteers are also coming from Britain. Science teacher Neith McMahon from Kent crossed the channel by ferry with food, clothes, and school supplies for the migrants. She heard about the school on Facebook.
I just felt really emotional about what's going on here, how these people are being treated. You know, they're desperate, they're running away from war and torture and suffering, and a lot of cases is caused by Western policies. So I wanted to do what I could.
Founder Zimiko Jones wants to establish another classroom just for women and children. The school is proof, he says, that migrants can create something positive in the jungle of Calais, and that Europe and its migrants can build a future together. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Calais, France.
Thousands of migrants continue to confound European transit systems. This as more people from the Middle East and Africa seek refuge among the member states of the European Union. Dozens of Hungarian police are blocking the gates of Budapest's Keleti railway station today as hundreds of migrants surround the station chanting freedom. An estimated 3,000 are camped nearby. Hungarian officials refused for a second day to let migrants board trains to Austria or Germany. On Monday, more than 3,000 boarded trains for Vienna. Flows have fallen, with Germany reporting only 50 migrant arrivals in Munich today, compared with 2,400 on Tuesday. Germany continues to accept large numbers of Syrian migrants and expects to receive more than 800,000 by the end of the year.
Hungarian government officials say they have decided to comply with the EU rules requiring proper documents to cross borders. They are considering deployment of 3,500 troops to reinforce barbed wire fences being erected at the Serbian border. Hundreds of rail passengers and five Eurostar trains between London and Paris were delayed for several hours last night. They waited without electricity or air conditioning at the entry to the tunnel beneath the English Channel. Meanwhile, authorities investigated possible damage to trains and reports of migrants blocking the tracks in the tunnel ahead. The International Organization for Migration says more than 350,000 migrants have landed on the European continent this year.
Also, Yehias, early flows across the Mediterranean to Italy have been eclipsed by new flows from Turkey bound for the Balkans. Turkish media reported that 11 migrants in two small boats drowned as they tried to cross the Aegean Sea to the Greek island of Kos. In the last 24 hours, the Greek Coast Guard rescued more than 1,000 migrants from 28 vessels. Authorities have also arrested six suspected smugglers. In the Mediterranean, a Norwegian vessel rescued 800 from a vessel in distress and delivered them to the port of Caularia on Sardinia. Although not a member of the EU, Iceland is also willing to take in migrants. When the government in Reykjavik has offered to take 50 migrants, citizens offered to take even more into their homes and suggested additional housing at an abandoned military base.
More than 300 illegal migrants, mostly Ethiopians, are detained in Malawi prisons after finishing their sentences. Government officials say the prolonged stay provides a place to live while readying for deportation. But rights groups say keeping people in prison after their term is finished is illegal. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi immigration authorities say these people were convicted of illegal entry into Malawi. They came through Tanzania on their way to South Africa. Department of Immigration spokesperson Joseph Ijawa describes those being held.
We have 358 countrywide, that is. And in Blantyre here, we have 7. In Deza, we have 32. In Nkisi, we have 64. And in Lilongwe, we have 255. Most of these are Ethiopians and the Congolese.
Chawa said many are just waiting to be sent back home. But prisoners' rights activist Victor Muhango condemns this.
That's illegal. They are actually breaking the law. They are keeping people, innocent people, in prison illegally. The law says you cannot keep somebody in prison after completing their sentences. And after all, you know our prisons are full and they are subject to cruel punishment after completing their sentences.
Malawi Chief Commissioner for Prisons, Kennedy Nkuma, told VOA the released migrants are being kept in prisons out of goodwill.
They are actually now housed because the Constitution of the Republic of Malawi allows to house them, rehabilitate them. So what we are now doing is to house them before they are repatriated to their respective countries. They do not wait, they just wake up in the morning and wait the time to be deported.
But Muhango is not convinced.
Is that the home or a prison? How come someone is provided a shelter in prison? Why not finding a better place to provide a shelter?
Doctors Without Borders deputy head of mission in Malawi, Nicolette Jackson, says her team has been providing medical help in clinics of two major Malawi prisons.
We see that many of them are malnourished. They don't eat the food. They don't like the food that is provided in prison, which is inadequate anyway. They get one meal a day, and it's enzema. It has no protein. So we see some of the Ethiopians suffering from a protein deficiency.
Jackson said some Ethiopians have been waiting 9 months for repatriation. Nkoma says the prolonged migrant prison stay is equally concerning to Malawi government authorities.
We are spending too much for these people where we are not supposed to spend. And the government has to hire a plane to take these people to Ethiopia. So that again is an expense of government.
Immigration spokesperson Chawa said he could not tell when the migrants will be flown back to their respective countries. He told VOA his department has no funds for such action. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight Live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I am Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The United Nations Children's Fund says the number of women and children fleeing countries of violence heading for Europe has increased sharply. And more than 300 illegal migrants, mostly Ethiopians, are detained in Malawi prisons after finishing their sentences. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The first ever World Hepatitis Summit is being held in Glasgow, Scotland this week. It's estimated 400 million people are infected with the viral disease, which kills nearly 1.5 million people a year. But a vaccine and treatment are now available. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization says most people living with the chronic disease do not even know they're infected. there are 5 different hepatitis viruses, A, B, C, D, and E. All cause inflammation of the liver, but 2 strains, B and C, cause most of the deaths. In fact, those 2 strains are responsible for 80% of all liver cancer deaths. The A and E strains are spread through contaminated food and water. They cause acute infection. However, most people recover. Dr. Stefan Victor says the B and C strains are different.
Hepatitis B and C are transmitted by blood, so that means from mother to a child, through blood transfusions or through injections. Hepatitis B can also be transmitted by sex, so there's different routes of transmission.
Victor is team leader of the World Health Organization's Global Hepatitis Program.
Luckily, we have ways to prevent all of them. There's a great vaccine for hepatitis B that is effective for life, and there's treatments for both B and C. So there are now in hand means of preventing and treating both infections. So really, this is the time to act, and that's really the point of this summit.
Hepatitis D is also transmitted through contaminated blood. However, it only affects people already infected with the B virus. Not long ago, no treatment was available for hepatitis C to prevent fatal liver damage.
One of the most remarkable advances in the development of medicines is the development of treatments for hepatitis C. Until recently, it was very difficult to cure. It required weekly injections, and only half of people who started the medicines were cured. Now, the medicines are about 12 weeks of treatment, 1 pill a day, and almost everyone is cured. And cured means that the virus is gone from their body.
But Dr. Victor says although a vaccine and treatments are available, not everyone in need can get them.
The problem has been that these medicines are very expensive. In the U.S., for example, it costs more than $100,000 to treat one person, just for the medicines. Luckily, the lower-income countries have been able to get these same medicines at much lower price, but a lot more has to happen to make these drugs affordable. And we estimate that it's a big problem. There's about 240 million people with chronic hepatitis B, and between 130 and 150 million for hepatitis C. So these are big problems.
One of the goals of the first World Hepatitis Summit is to urge countries to develop national hepatitis treatment and prevention programs.
We really need governments, civil society, private companies to make people aware.
He says the approach should be similar to that taken for HIV/AIDS. He says some routes of transmission are similar. And like HIV, hepatitis also carries a lot of stigma. Another similarity is that hepatitis, if untreated, does not kill right away. It can take decades for the virus to destroy the liver. The worst affected regions are in Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. The World Hepatitis Summit is co-sponsored by the WHO and the World Hepatitis Alliance. It's expected to become an annual event. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In South Sudan and Sudan, orphan girls and boys are not likely to learn to read and write. But that's changing thanks to an organization that specializes in educating them. Makeway Partners describes itself as the only indigenously operated relief organization in the region, helping vulnerable orphans and former slaves. So far, they're teaching more than 1,500 girls and boys. Kimberly Smith is president and co-founder of Makeway Partners. She spoke with me about their schools in South Sudan.
We actually have 3 schools. 2 in South Sudan, 1 near the border of Darfur, and 1 down near the border of Uganda. They're about 1,000 miles apart. And then the 3rd one is just across the north border in North Sudan of the Nuba Mountains. I'm excited to see what's happening in all of them, of course, in a country where education is so scant, and a 13-year-old girl has a higher likelihood of dying in childbirth than she does learning to read or write, become literate at all. And so I'm just so proud that we now have the first high school in the entire area where we are there near Darfur. So we have 750 students, and a little more than half of them are girls who every day study English, Dinka, which is their mother tongue, Kiswahili, so that they can be effective throughout this portion of Africa, but also Arabic.
What age ranges are the students in?
No one really knows their exact ages. And so it's difficult to say. We tend to assess children by their physical development. So, of course, there is a lot of margin for error there. But in the high school, our average girl will be between the ages of 12 and 20.
Are the high schools, are they a four-year high school?
Yes, 4 years.
What happens to the girls when they leave? Where do they go?
We haven't had that yet. We started in this particular region. We started just over 10 years ago, and we started with the first grade. We just did open enrollment, letting any child that first come, first serve, we did open enrollment, took in 153 students. And when some of those were able the very next year to move on to the second grade, and so we started as a second grade. The next year we opened the third grade and so forth. And so this year we now have 11th graders, what we would call 11th graders in our high school. And next year will be our first graduating class. And so we are extremely excited about that opportunity. Our goal will be to scholarship. There will be about 25 young men and women who, for the first time in this entire region, will be graduating high school, receive a diploma from high school. So it is definitely a big deal. And we will scholarship these children to neighboring countries, Uganda or Kenya, not here in the U.S., but neighboring African countries, where they can stay as close to their culture as possible, and they will be signing contracts to come back into the country and help serve within their country. The point is for internal change, but those contracts are really a small thing in that this is hunger and desire. They have been raised in this, and they see the difference between what life for them is and life for their siblings, for example, who didn't make it into the orphanage, or life just out in the community in general.
You brought up the high number of females in the high school,
yes,
which is really great to see. So how does this affect girls who sometimes don't get that opportunity to go to school?
One of the ways in which I see that it has affected them is the cultural pressure from outside is so huge that literally tells these girls that by the time you're menstruating, it is your duty to repopulate our country. But we'll have extended family members, uncles. We had one girl in particular who, when she was about 12 years old, uncle kidnapped her and tied her in his tukul, his little mud house, for 3 days, telling her it was her obligation to start having babies and could not be free and go back to school. We looked for her, could not find her. It took 3 days for her to get free and come back to us and tell us what had happened. Of course, we have been able to keep her. That young girl is now in our graduating class that will graduate next year. And so we see she was willing to stand up for the right to become literate, the right to do something special in her life. So she's planning on going on to medical school after graduation.
That was Kimberly Smith, president and co-founder of Makeway Partners. She was speaking with me from Rapid City, South Dakota.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, has been passed, signed, and reauthorized for the next decade, ensuring U.S.-African trade and investment will continue to flourish. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the outcome of the AGOA joint conference held in Gabon. That's next time on VOA Africa. VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The United Nations Children's Fund says the number of women and children fleeing countries of violence for Europe has increased sharply. And more than 300 illegal migrants, mostly Ethiopians, are detained in Malawi prisons after finishing their sentences. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, Burkina Faso's parliament debates on whether to abolish the death penalty in the country. I'm Kim Lewis with Yuhaya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with the All-Africa Games.
Kim, the 11th All-Africa Games will officially open Friday in Brazzaville, the capital of the Republic of the Congo. There will be competition in more than 20 sports, including men's and women's football. David Legg joins us again this evening for a look at the All-Africa Games men's football tournament.
Yes, Sonny, there was a blockbuster group, Group B, Egypt, Nigeria, Ghana, and Senegal. Very strong teams indeed, but sadly, Egypt have withdrawn. Their coach, Hassan El Badri, he said that national senior squad call-ups and also call-ups by clubs like Al Ahly and Zamalek for African club competitions would have severely weakened his squad. I still think it's a pity, Sonny. I think it was an opportunity, perhaps, to let fringe players get a chance. And I just have a feeling that it's really diluted a group that I was particularly looking forward to. In the other group, you've got the Republic of Congo, you've got Sudan, Zimbabwe, and Burkina Faso. And here, with home advantage and a wily old coach in Claude Leroy, I fancy the Congolese will come out on top, leaving Sudan, Zimbabwe, and Burkina Faso in a three-way fight for second place. The other group, you've got this great rivalry, of course, between Nigeria and Ghana and Senegal. They're going to host the CAF Under-23 Championship in December. I hasten to add that the All-Africa Games, also restricted to Under-23 footballers. I would tip Nigeria and Ghana, Sonny, to come through there. But what's going to be vital, I think, is the availability of players. This competition doesn't fall under the FIFA calendar as such, and therefore the national coaches of all these competing nations, they basically have to go and beg the clubs for the star players. So my long-term prediction, Sonny, for the All-Africa Games in the Republic of Congo, I'm going for a Congo versus Nigeria final.
David, let's turn to Europe now. Can you give us an update on some of the recent African goal-scoring highlights?
Yes, Sonny, and somebody who's done really well, has adapted very quickly to the English Premier League, is Andre Ayew. He's the son, of course, of the legendary Ghanaian star, Abede Pele. He scored his third goal in four matches for Swansea City in a 2-1 victory over Manchester United. It really was a tremendous weekend for Africans in England. Bakary Sako of Crystal Palace, he's a Malian. He scored one goal and created the other in perhaps the most stunning result of the weekend. Crystal Palace going to Chelsea, the reigning champions, and winning by 2-1. And yet another African in a big upset was Diafra Sako. He plays for West Ham United. He's Senegalese. He scored a third goal as West Ham United demolished Liverpool 3-0 at Anfield. And that, wait for it, Sonny, was the first time that West Ham have won at Liverpool in 52 years. That is more than half a century. Quite an amazing statistic and an amazing result. If you had said to me last Saturday morning, West Ham 3, Liverpool 0, I would have said, Sonny, you've got to see a doctor urgently. There is a big problem there somewhere. Staying in England, Sonny, Sadio Mane, He's a Southampton winger from Senegal, and he has been linked with a transfer to Manchester United. And he showed his worth again. He created two of the three goals as Southampton beat Norwich by 3-0. If we move on to Spain, there were goals for Cedric Bakambu from the DR Congo. He scored for Villarreal. Yusuf El Arabi, and a name that I really love, Isaac Success. He's a Nigerian, so he's bound to be successful. They both play for Granada, and they scored a goal each, so well done to them. And at the other end of the field, Carlos Kameni, he's the ex-Cameroon national team goalkeeper. He was outstanding from Malaga against Barcelona. A very brave effort in the Camp Nou by Malaga, but eventually the Lionel Messi-inspired Barca won by 1-0. Africans who shone in Italy included Mohamed Salah for Roma. He's an Egyptian, and Serge Gakpé, he's a Togolese player. He scored one of the two goals for Genoa in a 2-0 victory over Verona. In France, among the goal scorers were Boufal for Lille, he's a Moroccan. Sio, an Ivorian, scored for Rennes. And Kazri, a Tunisian, he was on target for Bordeaux. And when we come to Germany, Sonny, it seems like every week it's the same story. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang from Gabon. He has now scored 7 in 8 matches for Borussia Dortmund, who made a tremendous start to the season. Unbelievably, really, they're top of the table, because that's a position normally occupied by only one club, Bayern Munich. Another scorer in Germany of African interest was Salomon Kalou. He's the former Chelsea striker, and he scored for Hertha Berlin. So a really productive weekend, Sonny, for the African goal poachers around Europe.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. And we'll hear more soccer-licious analysis from David later this week, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled One-on-One with Luol Deng, and I reflect on the recent visit to our Voice of America headquarters by the South Sudan-born basketball star. In an interview with the Sunny Side of Sports, the 30-year-old Deng paid tribute to Dikembe Mutombo, who will be officially enshrined in the Basketball Hall of Fame next week.
You know, every time anyone says the name Mutombo, the first thing you do is smile. It's really amazing because he's just, he's been a great example for the continent, a great human being. Been teaching all of us a lot of things, all the young basketball players. And that's, I haven't even spoke about, you know, what he's done on the court, everything that really he stands for. He's done a great job of just showing everyone in the whole wide world who he really is without the basketball. And just like you said, he's that good to be, you know, a Hall of Famer. And that's something that, you know, going to be remembered for a long time.
Do you view him as maybe a role model in terms of your own humanitarian work?
No, of course. Of course. I mean, I can't sit here and say I haven't, you know, seen what he's done or haven't heard about it. And I think all those things affect you. All those positive things makes you, you know, one day want to just do similar things that he's done. And he's just been so great and so active in putting the continent out there and letting everyone know what's going on. And at the same time, spending time and putting people together in order to do something great to help others. So he's definitely a role model.
That's South Sudan-born basketball star Luol Deng of the Miami Heat speaking at our VOA studios here in Washington. Deng is the subject of my latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post. The Sunny Side of Sports remembers Charles Kumi Gyamfi, a legendary Ghanaian footballer and coach who has died at age 85. C.K. Gyamfi was the first African footballer to play in Germany when he joined Fortuna Dusseldorf in 1960. Gyamfi also captained the Black Stars, Ghana's national team, and as coach of the Black Stars, C.K. Gyamfi led them to three Nations Cup trophies in 1963, 1965, and 1982. Those three titles made Gyamfi the most successful coach in Nations Cup history, a record that was matched by Egypt's Hassan Shahata when he won a third Nations Cup championship in 2010. The Ghana Football Association is mourning the death of C.K. Gyamfi. The GFA said the following on Twitter: "It's with great sadness that we learned of the passing of the legendary Ghanaian coach and footballer, C.K. Gyamfi. The GFA is immensely hurt by the loss of such a talented footballer and coach who shaped the lives and careers of many Ghanaian footballers. We wish to extend deepest condolences to the family of C.K. Gyamfi, and most importantly, to his wife, children, friends, and loved ones." In more African football news, former Nigeria captain Segun Odegbami is the third African candidate to declare he's running for president of FIFA, the sports world governing body. The 63-year-old Odegbami conceded his bid may be a long shot. In a statement, he said, and I quote, "The choice of an African, specifically a Nigerian, may look far-fetched in this pursuit. However, a closer scrutiny of the international football environment reveals the real possibility of such chance." Odegbami joins another Nigerian, former state governor Orji Uzor Kalu, and Liberia Football Association president Musa Bility, as Africans saying they want to be on the FIFA presidential ballot on February 26, 2016. Another African, South African businessman Tokio Sexwale, is considering running for the position to be vacated by Sepp Blatter following a corruption scandal that broke out in May. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. Charles Jacob Correa sent me a tweet from Kenya saying, "C.K. Gyamfi took Ghana to three Nations Cup titles, exactly what a patriot would do." Thanks for that tweet, Charles. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Burkina Faso's parliament debating on whether to abolish the death penalty in the country. And next, the International Organization of Migration says the number of people fleeing East Africa, Syria, and South Asia is getting worse. But first, some music. Here is Jody Clark of Liberia with Knockout.
Baby, you knock me out.
Jody.
To stare at you, cause your beauty side of sight. Girl, I'll do anything to keep you here with me.
Jody Clark of Liberia with Knockout.
Well, Burkina Faso's parliament recently opened a debate on whether to abolish the death penalty in the country. Gaetan Mutu, a researcher at Amnesty International, tells Ricky Shryock the odds are high that the country will officially abolish the death penalty at the September 6th vote.
During the parliamentary sessions, which should be held as from Friday, there will be a debate on the bill regarding the abolition of the death penalty in Burkina Faso.
How likely is it that at this session the leaders will vote to abolish the death penalty?
We are very happy that the bill will be debated at the Transitional Assembly. We believe that the tendency towards abolition is moving forward, especially in Burkina Faso, because the Transitional Assembly proposed a bill to the government, and it looks like the government has accepted the bill as signing off and has sent it back to Parliament to be voted.
Is there any chance, though, since this is a transitional government, that even if this abolition happens and the death penalty is abolished right now, it could eventually come back because a new leader could say this happened under the transitional government, so it's null and void, doesn't count?
I think that it's unlikely that the decision to move backward will happen because the Transitional Assembly has got the same rights as the former parliament, which was deposed after the unrest last year.
Is there anyone on death row right now in Burkina? And in the past, what have been the conditions that someone would get sentenced to the death penalty?
There are many causes. The death penalty is still in force in Burkina Faso, but over the last 3 decades, nobody has been executed in Burkina Faso. It's a de facto abolitionist country, and there was a big movement towards the abolition of the death penalty in Burkina Faso.
What's popular opinion? And in regards to that, how has traditional culture in Burkina Faso regarded the death penalty?
It is interesting just to note that the way forward towards abolition has been raised with political leaders, with organizations of civil society, and also with religious bodies, so that this bill could be approved. However, it would be difficult for me just to assess whether the people in Burkina Faso will agree to this decision. But however, working with a human rights organization, I tend to meet mainly people working with non-governmental organizations and human rights organizations, and most of them are, or if not all of them, are in favor of the abolition of the death penalty. And they have been working with traditional leaders, they have been working with citizens in the villages to prepare for the abolition of the death penalty. Having said that, I do understand that there are some people who may be opposed to the abolition of the death penalty in Burkina Faso.
There will be a parliamentary vote on the 6th of September as to whether to abolish the death penalty or not. After that vote, does it go into law or does it need another approval?
Yes, it will go into law. The law has got to be signed by the president and then it is a law.
That was Gaetan Mutu, a West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Paris.
The International Organization of Migration says the number of people fleeing East Africa, Syria and South Asia is getting worse. Europe has struggled to stem the flow of migrants. 2,300 have drowned in the Mediterranean this year, trying to reach Greece and Italy. Vincent Macori recently talked about the situation with a spokesman for the IOM, Itai Biriri.
Well, unfortunately, we don't see any end in sight because of what we have been saying all along, that there's lack of coordination amongst the European Union member states. We have called for a more coordinated approach in terms of dealing with the numbers that are arriving, so making sure that all those 250,000 or more that have arrived mostly in Greece and Italy can be spread on to the other countries in the rest of the EU. We're talking of an economic bloc with 28 countries. So the common sense will be that they will be able to share these numbers evenly. But what we're seeing so far is that quite a lot of these migrants are either staying in Italy or Greece, and very few are managing to continue on to go to countries like Germany, Sweden, or the UK.
Now, this has been going on for a long time now. What has been impeding any kind of concrete, comprehensive strategy or plan by the Europeans?
Well, some countries have not been very forthcoming in terms of taking up as many numbers as they could. So, for example, countries like Hungary have said that they are not interested in taking in numbers per capita on a per capita basis. So that means that then the burden remains on the likes of Italy and Greece. And so far we're seeing, the numbers that are trying to reach, say, for example, the UK, where the situation in Calais, you're only talking of a very, very small number comparatively, less than 5,000. And if you consider that Greece has received over 150,000 and Italy 100,000, then you can see the scale of the kind of support and assistance that those two countries need from the rest of the EU.
Now, Itai, is it just me seeing things this way, or are these numbers increasing, at least in the last few months?
They certainly have. Normally every year, I would say in the last 5 or 6 years, the summer season is when these journeys, migrants make these journeys because the sea is a bit calmer, not as rough and choppy as it is in the winter. So we always expect this to happen. But certainly the numbers are right now projected to be much higher than they've been in recent years. And already we've also been talking of high death rates, of people trying to cross the Mediterranean. So far, over 2,300 have died. Whereas the whole of last year, 3,200 people died. So, we were trying to sort of figure out how and why the numbers are going as high as they are. Obviously, we're also looking at protracted conflicts around the world, with the addition now of Yemen.
Now, question is, do you get a sense of why people persist despite of all these tragic stories on the Mediterranean?
I think it's desperation. I mean, it just shows how desperate people are to get away from whether it's conflict or countries where there's human rights abuses, countries where there are, they just find that it's untenable for them to stay. So we speak to some of the people who make these journeys and those who survive the crossings, and they tell of situations where they feel they had no other choice. And I think that realization still hasn't reached some of the decision makers in Europe to really realize how desperate and you know, people have no other opportunity, or they feel that they have no other opportunity to survive. So you get that sense that even if they know what has happened to others who have not made it, or the difficulties of actually staying in Europe, because sometimes they're not guaranteed to be allowed to stay in Europe, they still would make the journeys anyway.
That was a spokesman for the International Organization of Migration. He was speaking with reporter Vincent McCorry. This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Modern slavery is a blight on humanity and is nearly universally condemned, but it does not exist in a vacuum. Trafficking in persons is often perpetrated by well-organized transnational criminal gangs that ensure smooth operations through bribery. In the process, they destroy not only the lives of people whom they enslave, they degrade entire economies. Slavery doesn't just destroy communities and harm everyday people. It fuels a network of ruthless criminals and armed groups that create insecurity and instability around the world, said David Luna, a senior director in the Office of Anti-Crime Programs at the U.S. State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs. The societal harms and impacts posed by human trafficking are very real. Corruption helps to fuel it and enriches not only those criminal networks behind today's modern slavery, but also enables corrupt police, customs, judicial, and other security officials who protect traffickers and allow them to carry out their criminal activities. Modern slavery recognizes no borders, and therefore, just as no economy is immune from corruption, no single jurisdiction can solve this problem on its own. To defeat this scourge, the community of nations must begin by making clear to the public how much harm human trafficking causes to communities and educating vulnerable populations about the methods used to ensnare and exploit those they enslave. We must also increase the scrutiny of supply chains where little to none may exist. Governments must adopt the highest standards of accountability and human rights protection and ensure that their suppliers and contractors are held to those standards as well. At the same time, international organizations and companies must enforce policies against human trafficking throughout their supply chains. Mechanisms must be established to report cases of abuse, harassment, or violence, and to identify and protect victims of trafficking. Human trafficking siphons away the human capital potential of communities to build sustainable economic growth in a manner that respects human rights, said Mr. Luna. No person should ever have a price tag attached to their heart and soul, nor be restricted, abused, and violated against their physical integrity and free will.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, has been passed, signed, and reauthorized for the next decade, ensuring U.S. African trade and investment will continue to flourish. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the outcome of the AGOA joint conference held in Gabon. That's next time on VOA Africa.